Hello and welcome to the Bloomberg Tech Disruptors podcast. In this podcast series, we talk with CEOs and management teams about their views on disruption and how it's driving their decision-making and strategy. My name is Mandeep, and with me today is Charlie Flanagan, Head of Applied AI at Balyasny Asset Management. Charlie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. You have a very interesting background, and you know, when we were thinking about putting this episode together, what really intrigued me was the fact that you've worked at Google, and obviously you've been at Balyasny for a while. So perhaps you can talk about your current role as Head of Applied AI and what you do in your day-to-day work, and we'll kick off from there.
That sounds great. Just introduce Balyasny Asset Management. It's commonly referred to as BAM. We're a $21 billion asset manager, commonly referred to as a multi-strategy hedge fund. And that means we do things like equities, commodities, systematic, macro, and we also have a private markets group called BAM Elevate. So it's kind of, we look across the investment universe as a firm.
Okay, and your role, like what does Head of Applied AI mean at Balyasny?
The Applied AI Group is a centralized function within the firm, which is really an empowerment team for lots of other organizations within the firm. We're very focused on empowering all teams within BAM to leverage AI in their everyday work. And the way that we do that is, you know, educating a lot of folks. We are very focused on bring the best technologies into the firm and helping folks understand how to use them, you know, in a way that's, you know, both productive, but also they're using them in the way that they're getting the most out of the tool and safely. We're very focused on research, understanding not just what's possible now, but also where are we going in the future and building towards that. And then also, of course, building tools that other folks can build on top of. So we're very much focused on empowering both technical and non-technical teams by giving them tools where they can actually go and actually leverage the power of generative AI and AI in general in their own workflows.
So talking about tools, I mean, clearly, you know, when we talk to a lot of companies across different domains, they've been using machine learning and some form of AI classification systems, recommendation systems for almost 10 years now. Now, this last 12 months has really been about this wave of generative AI and LLMs. Talk me through, you know, how that has changed the way you are thinking about tools, and if there are any case studies you would want to highlight, given this is such a new technology.
Yeah, certainly. I think BAM has been on a similar journey to a lot of other firms in that, you know, we've had centralized natural language understanding teams and machine learning teams for many, many years. So certainly AI broadly defined is not new to the firm, but you're correct. In the last 12 months, what has changed is large language models and really, you know, understanding new capabilities that that gives us. One of my favorite things about BAM is just the vast amount of data that we have access to. The part of that data, because we had a centralized natural language understanding team for many years, was actually textual in nature. And there were lots of things we could do with that, but really with large language models, the possibilities are kind of endless. And so we were well placed that about a year ago, as soon as ChatGPT entered the public consciousness, to actually onboard the OpenAI GPT-4 model. We were able to do it kind of through getting by a privately hosted version of the model via Microsoft in our own environment. And, you know, building on top of it, we had all the textual assets in place to really kind of start understanding quickly, you know, the art of the possible. I would say 2023 was the year where we saw a lot of prototyping. You know, we took the approach of let's give the systems, the APIs, the front ends that we had built to everybody within the firm and understand what the art of the possible is. You know, very concretely, that looked like hackathons. We put together a lot of education systems, having hackathons where folks were coming in, spending some time training with the models, and then actually going in, spending 48 hours building prototypes. That gave us a lot of good insight into where the models were working well, where the gaps were. And since then, really, we've been kind of taking the best of what we've seen built there and in other places within the firm and elevating it to, you know, for everyone across the firm to be able to benefit. You know, certainly some of my favorite examples at the moment are within our some of our investment teams. Our chief economist within the macro group had a really great example recently where he has a standard report or analysis that he himself and another analyst do on a monthly basis. Usually takes him about 2 days for every single central bank announcement. And they were able to break down the process of their analysis into smaller chunks, look at the opportunities for leveraging LLMs within those analyses, and we have been able to take that two-day analysis that has previously took two people down to something that just takes 30 minutes now. Just a huge amount of savings, right? That in itself is impressive, but even more so when he told me that it only took him about 4 hours of coding to actually get to that.
Okay. Now that sounds very interesting. And what I found really interesting in your comment was you do this on-prem, even though you are using GPT-4, you're using that Microsoft instance on-prem and then layering your custom data. Is that the right way to frame it?
Yes. You know, BAM is quite, you know, very tech forward. So we leverage all of the different cloud providers. We have our own tooling in-house as well, of course. But, you know, I think the firm is not afraid to use the best tooling wherever it exists. So it's one of my favorite things because it allows my team and lots of other teams within the firm to move very quickly.
So I know, you know, firms like JP Morgan and Goldman have banned the use of LLM like ChatGPT because of data leakage concerns. I'm guessing since you guys have, you know, customized GPT-4, employees are allowed to use it?
That is correct. But of course, we've taken all the necessary safeguards to ensure privacy and, you know, all sorts of compliance rules being followed. So that's, you know, around actually agreeing with Microsoft and OpenAI that no data would be used for training, no data would be retained from training. It kind of all sits within our own isolated instance in the Azure system. And of course, you know, maintaining books and records, right? You know, making sure that we have all the systems in place that we're built, you know, we don't use the consumer facing versions of ChatGPT. We've built our own internal system that allows us to actually build lots of additional tools that are specific to our own teams on top of it.
Got it. So, I mean, I know you probably wouldn't want to disclose your secret sauce or, you know, the data sets that you're training the large language model on, but curious to hear, and even in the example that you cited, like, what is it that you are using the fine-tuning aspect for? I mean, because the LLMs, GPT-4 as such, has got a great knowledge base and, you know, it can answer a lot of questions. And some of the tasks that you mentioned were automated or kind of the productivity gain was seen for the economists that you mentioned. Couldn't it be done with the raw version of GPT-4, or how much fine-tuning are we talking about? And then what's the process like in general? What does training or fine-tuning a model entail when it comes to your specific environment?
The one thing that I like to emphasize when we're training and talking to folks internally is that, you know, the GPT-4 model and lots of other models that we leverage, they're extremely good. But they're not databases. And I think that's the most important thing to understand, right? If I could, you know, write one thing out time and time again, it would be that. It is not a database. It looks like a database. It feels like a database. In our own personal lives, we use it as such, right? You know, write me an itinerary for a trip that's coming up, or, you know, a recipe or something like that. But in an enterprise setting, right, particularly one like our own, where we have very specific data sets that we're dealing with, it's actually kind of dangerous to use it as such. It's actually better to use it as a reasoning engine, and actually quite a simple reasoning engine at that. There's still a lot of work to be done to make it deal with more complex logic. So what that looks like really is actually plugging the system into all of our internal knowledge bases. Okay, the terminology in this area is called retrieval augmented generation. Keyword being retrieval. So instead of just asking a model a question and getting an answer, we actually first plug it into all of our, you know, research systems, broker research, management transcripts, that type of thing. And when we're asking a question of the model, instead of trying to answer it using its internal knowledge base, it first actually reaches out to our internal document corpus or other data that we've given it access to. It tries to find the most relevant information within that to answer the question. It pulls that back in, the keyword there being the retrieval, and that's where we spend a lot of our time in the research side, actually making that retrieval really, really good. And it uses the model just for the very last part of actually saying, okay, here's the information that is most relevant to answer this question that's being asked. Now I'm going to go and answer it. We're not reliant on the actual system's knowledge itself. That in itself is what can lead to things like hallucinations.
Got it. Okay. No, that actually explains it quite well. So I guess this is one example where you're using the model for reasoning. And I could argue, you know, with the RAG approach, you can use it for summarizing different kinds of things, et cetera. What about, you know, generating trading ideas or alpha generation, given, you know, I mean, yeah, you're such a big fund and the assets under management. Is that a use case that you would consider using an LLM for?
It's certainly one we're exploring, I would say. But I think that we're building towards that. But what I would say is the models can be used in two different ways. It can be used for process automation and, you know, just gaining efficiencies. And it can be also used for helping gain new insights. The process automation perspective of helping folks, you know, get to insights faster is kind of where I would say about 80% of the resources are right now, because there's such a long list of things that we know that we can use these systems for and that they will most likely work and in fact are working. So, you know, think about that as analysts using it to automate the creation of morning notes, or, you know, if they're going into a management meeting, being able to actually have our systems look over vast amounts of research, far more than an analyst would have time to review themselves, and actually give them salient points that they should kind of talk to management about that are most interesting. And then on the new insight side, you know, we're certainly seeing really interesting things happening there too. But we're at the limitations of where the models are. So we're doing a lot of research here. Things get really interesting when you're actually using the model to maybe compare things, consensus views versus non-consensus views within a particular piece of research, right? We see interesting things there. But for me, actually, on the research side within insights, what's been most recently interesting recently is using the models not so much to answer questions directly, but to ask better questions. Okay, so what we've been doing is we've had some of our researchers looking back at, you know, huge amounts of textual information related to a company or a company's suppliers or its competitors, and actually, you know, reading the actual research itself and then coming up with the outstanding questions that it wants it to answer, right? And that gets really interesting, because then all of a sudden we're asking, having the model actually come up with its own novel questions that are thought-provoking. So when we show it to analysts and PMs, they're like, wow, this is a really interesting question. I should answer that. I should figure out where the actual data is to answer that particular question. I hadn't thought to ask that before. Starting with really interesting questions then starts us on the path of actually, okay, now let's go and use the same systems to try and find the elements that might help our investment teams answer that question. But for me, that's been the biggest eye-opening experience in the last month is, you know, actually the quality of the novel questions we're able to get the systems to generate.
No, that sounds fascinating. In fact, just to piggyback on that, so in this case, does the system get smarter over time as you interact more with it, or it all depends on the knowledge base that you have connected it to, and then I guess it will learn your preferences, but not necessarily get smarter?
So the underlying model, the foundation model itself, stays the same. But I mentioned that we're, you know, really focused on the retrieval step of retrieval augmented generation. So that continues to get better and better. We're really focused on building the world's best financial retrieval system. And there's so much to be done there. You know, metadata tagging, understanding of text. You mentioned earlier in the conversation, fine-tuning. That's a big focus of fine-tuning efforts is, you know, can we better, you know, store that data and retrieve the most relevant information that are that is specific to macro commodities. You know, if you read some of these documents, it's like they're their own separate language, right? You know, if you, I don't know if you've ever, you've, I'm sure you've read a an announcement from the Federal Reserve. You know, trying to dissect some of that language is almost its own separate language. So the way that we kind of store that and retrieve that, we actually can build some fine-tuned systems to make that really, really good. The better the retrieval, the better the information we can pass into the model to actually produce the answers.
And is there a real-time aspect to it? Like one of the, I guess, criticisms or constraints that we have heard about using LLMs is their knowledge gets dated. So is that problem solved by using this RAG approach, or is there any other way to address that?
Yes. For keeping fresh information available to the model, RAG, retrieval augmented generation, is the correct approach here. And for ourselves, as you imagine, we have large systems that are ingesting data all the time in either real time or near real time. So certainly for some of the textual assets that we have access to, we in most cases, we see no more than like a 15-minute delay in ingesting them once they've actually been published by the different sources that are being made available.
And most of these models highlight their multimodal capabilities. I'm guessing you are dealing more with text and you know, financial time series data, or is it really multimodal in true sense?
You know, you'd be surprised. And actually, for me, it's been a surprising aspect. Just the GPT-4 vision model became available recently, and you know, we knew that we would certainly be interested in exploring it, but the appetite internally has been quite large for that and other multimodal models that have recently become available. You know, some of it you can think of as traditional images, right? Satellite images, for example. But when you actually break it down, there's actually a lot of images just within the textual documents themselves. Every chart, every table, you can think of as an image, right? And we see a lot of focus in terms of actually trying to extract more information from those and make those searchable, retrievable, getting, you know, adding those to the analysis also. So we've been doing a lot of research in this area. I would say the results at the moment are a little bit underwhelming. We're just scratching the surface. You know, the GPT-4 vision model just became available. So hallucinations is a real problem over table understanding and images of tables. So a lot of these tools, I think, are going to be, including multimodal, are going to be extremely helpful. But like everything, you need to do the research and use them where they can do a good job at the moment. But of course, building for the future when they actually get better and better.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I mean, I tend to ask these questions to all the guests on our podcast about hype versus reality. So based on what you have said so far, it doesn't look like this is real, and what you're doing will drive, you know, real changes in the day-to-day workflow. I'm guessing the job of the analysts and PMs would change. I mean, talk to me about the talent needed to deploy this kind of technology at scale, and how do you see it changing the jobs at a firm like yours?
It's certainly an exciting time. And personally, what I love about BAM is that it's always been a very innovative culture, very tech forward. So, you know, we really have seen people eager to adopt the new technology and understand what the art of the possible is and experiment. You know, I already mentioned we're a big fan of hackathons here. So we've had a lot of hackathons where we've seen investment teams and other engineering teams within the firm really kind of lean in to kind of push the boundaries on what's possible. As we think about the effect of on the roles themselves, you know, the way I like to think about it is, I don't think that's going to replace any roles or change any roles dramatically, but it will, what it will change is tasks, right? The tasks within a role will change. So, you know, I already mentioned the example of morning mote generation, right? For an analyst coming in and looking at research news overnight that's applicable to their coverage list, you know, there's a lot that we can do there to help assist them in that, right? Just to, you know, extract the relevant information, summarize it. We move them from being a creator to an editor, right? That allows them to get to that piece of work faster, the insights faster, and then, of course, focus on the analysis, which is where most of the value actually lives.
So have these folks ever come back to you and said, Charlie, can you explain how the system generated this response, or does it sound like a black box to them and they're really trying to figure out how is the system actually, you know, coming up with all these responses? There has to be a pattern or algorithm that's driving underneath, right?
You're exactly right. You know, we deal with a lot of smart folks here who are critical thinkers by nature. So, you know, if we give them an insight and answer, they want to know how it is derived. And we very much take the trust but verify approach here. So when any of our systems either give an answer or push a proactive insight, the first thing we do is we append a source. We tell them, here is where we got this information. We have this opinion. We have this insight, this answer, because of this, and this document, right? And here are the links to it. You should go and check it for yourself, confirm. Oftentimes, you know, the insight that we're providing, the answer, is just a starting point for them, right? Particularly, I mentioned if we're just providing questions, well, then that's really the starting point where they have to do a lot of work. So, you know, really we understood from the very beginning that, particularly when people are hearing the media about hallucinations and the risks around those, that we needed, if we're rolling these systems out, we have to be responsible from the very beginning and giving them the information to build trust.
And so would it be fair to characterize this system as an indexing system as well, because you are indexing information and you are sourcing, you know, where the responses are coming from?
Yes, I think that would be fair for one of the systems. So of course, our team and our firm have built many solutions in this space, but one of the big ones we're focused on is providing, you know, an assistant type of framework for analysts and PMs to be able to interact with and ask questions, get answers, but also, you know, start providing proactive insights, right? Actually, instead of relying on folks to, you know, go and ask the relevant questions, right? We're very focused on how do we actually, in advance, figure out what questions folks might be interested in asking it on their behalf, and then pushing those insights out where they're actually, where we think there's real signal or interesting insights to be had there.
Got it. Perhaps we can spend a couple of minutes on infrastructure. I mean, we read all the time about the supply constraints around the availability of GPUs, H100s. Is that what you're using to, you know, fine tune the model and the Microsoft Azure infrastructure? Do you see any constraints, or is that something that has improved over time?
There are certainly capacity constraints in the industry. We hear about it all the time from colleagues at other firms. I think that BAM was well positioned here simply because we had those centralized resources, NLP teams and machine learning teams for the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. So therefore, we had relationships with all the major cloud providers and other compute providers within the ecosystem, which has allowed us to, you know, gain access to both GPUs directly, but also, you know, other services and APIs that those cloud providers make available. So far, we haven't had any capacity constraints, but I'm aware that it is a big issue more broadly.
And when it comes to inferencing, is that something that's available on employee devices, or it has to be done within the firewall and the systems that you have in place?
So everything that we provide is, you know, that these large systems that we build, we make available. They're accessible to the employees through both the internal tools that we've built, front ends and other tools. We're very focused on meeting folks where they are, if they prefer email or Slack or other kind of messaging services. The other piece of this is just the APIs, right? We make everything, we want all teams to be able to leverage the different tools that we've built or the other models that are available. So, you know, we're not certainly not limited to OpenAI. We make open source models available, you know, other foundation model providers available also. So we really try and meet our users where they are. And if that means that they want to get programmatic access, we enable that, or if they need front ends built around their workflow, we're also well positioned to provide that. We're very focused on allowing folks to, you know, empower themselves. They're best placed to understand how to leverage this technology within their own workflow.
And I know, you know, financial services companies are more concerned about the compliance aspect of it. Is that something you deal with on a day-to-day basis, especially given the new technology and, you know, not much being there in terms of a precedent?
Yeah, I think it's certainly been a learning curve for everybody in terms of the compliance aspects here. I think we're lucky to have a very forward-thinking compliance team who were, you know, quick to understand that this would be transformational and that everyone would want to adopt it. And they put in place, you know, guidance and frameworks and systems to be able to allow us to roll out these tools and services in both a compliant and a safe way.
Got it. Okay, so I like to keep the last 5 minutes for some lightning round where, you know, we touch on different topics and you can keep your answers brief. So in terms of the ratio of responses, you know, accurate responses versus hallucinations, how would you characterize the use of LLMs at BAM right now?
Collectively, the research would tell you that hallucinations could occur as frequently as about 3% of the time. We work really, really hard to build retrieval systems and other verifications, and we're pretty confident that we have it below a half of 1%. And then even within that, we have other systems that help people verify if we think something's at risk.
Got it. Do you think we will have finance vertical specific LLMs over the next 1 to 2 years?
Yes, but not specifically just one large model that's focused on a particular industry. I do think a lot of that will happen in the retrieval step, the back end, where how do you better understand all the textual assets related to finance, law, you know, many other domains, medicine, for example, and, you know, retrieve them. The large systems actually seem to be pretty good at that reasoning task. But I think a lot of the fine tuning for vertical specific apps will actually be in the back ends in the retrieval space.
Got it. And what about data leakage? Do you think it will be a big challenge for the industry as a whole, especially on the finance side in your domain where, you know, the alpha is generated by the data you harness over time? And curious to know your thoughts around data leakage.
I think that if you work with your cloud providers or the other model providers where, you know, at the very beginning, you're putting the agreements and systems in place to prevent that, much like any other data sets or services you use from them, you know, if it's living within a controlled environment that only you can access, even if it's within one of the cloud providers, you know, you should be fine.
Which workflow do you think will change the most at your firm as a result of GenAI deployment?
Honestly, I think everyone's jobs will change. We're really focused this year on trying to help folks automate 10% of their roles, right? The stuff that should be automated, right? That's frustrating that you have to do repetitively, and giving them the tools to do so. You know, within the investment functions, which is obviously a big focus for our firm, you know, a lot of that overnight news, right? Just, you know, keeping track of all of the possible research that you can and should be ingesting, all the events that are happening, not just in a company, but within its competitors. You know, there's so much that an analyst or PM needs to keep track of. Us helping them with that and pushing out proactive insights and perhaps questions that the AI thinks could or should be interesting to pursue, I think that actually will be one of the big shifts in the workflow over the next couple of years.
And on a related note, do you expect anything to be fully automated as a result of LLM deployment?
Yes, but I think a lot of the opportunities there actually come within the engineering world. Within our firm, we have a lot of folks who are writing code, and we see them getting a lot of productivity improvements through the use of code assistant tools. And there are elements of that, particularly the downstream. After you've written a piece of code, there's so much more deployment, testing the code. There's all of that, I think, has the potential to be fully automated. And we already see really good success here. You know, we've actually had about 1 million lines of code added to our code base in the last few months by AI. And, you know, we think it lifts developer productivity by about 30%.
Wow, 1 million lines of code. That's very impressive. Anything that could go wrong with the assumptions that you're making around deploying this technology? It sounds like, you know, you are at the cutting edge. Curious to hear your thoughts around what do you think could go wrong?
The way I think about it is, you know, we're very focused on, okay, let's build for right now, but also let's set ourselves up and do the research for the future. So making some bets on what a GPT-5, a GPT-6 will be capable of, particularly in the areas of like complex reasoning and logic. The systems today are, you know, you can think about them as maybe system one thinking, if you've ever read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow book, right?
Yeah.
But we're
system
moving
one
into
and two, yeah.
System one and two, right? Uh-huh. Simple questions, simple answers, but system two being more complex reasoning. We're very focused on building for the future where we can assume more complex reasoning is possible from these models. The issue is, of course, progress here is very fast, but it's also nonlinear, right? We see a lot of news coming out, but actually the questions around GPT-5, GPT-6 ability to do planning and logic, you know, it is still very unclear. So I guess the risks are that, you know, we're very much building both for right now, but also in the future. It's just unclear what the next versions of the models will be capable of. But what we're trying to do is set ourselves up for success by putting the building blocks in place now so that we'll automatically gain from those improvements over time.
Got it. And lastly, any misconceptions about BAM or generative AI in general that you want to clear on this podcast?
I think you can tell from my answers that, you know, I'm a real optimist here. I think it's such an exciting time. I think there's so much that we can do. I think we need to be very pragmatic about, you know, where the models have limitations, but build for, you know, for what they can do well right now and then prepare for the future. Certainly when I hear folks talk about, you know, role replacement or, you know, people being put out of jobs, I've gone back and I've looked at newspaper clippings from the 1950s, 1980s, and it almost exactly the same headlines occurred with the technology advances that occurred then as well. I don't think it's going to change that many roles. What it's going to do is change the tasks, right? The actual tasks that people are doing on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's going to change it really for the better. So I think everyone should be embracing it. I think everyone should be experimenting. I think people should be building. But I think people should be ultimately very optimistic.
Charlie, I share your optimism. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was a really fun conversation, and I want to wish you the very best.
Thank you so much.